And we're live with our 331st episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Excited to be here as always. This week it is just Ken and I. We'll be discussing a few different topics, mainly related to all the news and noise and AI agents related from DEF CON and Black Hat and Hacker Summer Camp, whatever you want to call it. So we're going to dive into that here shortly. Before we do, I do want to give a shout out to Guard Square for sponsoring this episode. Think about your mobile app's source code. Once it hits the app store, it's out in the wild, and without the right protection, decompiling is easy for malicious actors looking to steal your IP or tamper with your software. That's where GuardSquare comes in. GuardSquare provides the highest level of mobile app security for Android and iOS applications and SDKs. Their advanced tools integrate seamlessly into your CI/CD pipeline. We're talking polymorphic, multi-layered code hardening techniques and automated runtime application self-protection, paired with mobile application security testing and real-time threat monitoring to deliver the highest level of mobile app security without compromise. Don't leave your hard work exposed. Secure your mobile applications today. Go to guardsquare.com to learn more. Appreciate GuardSquare, them sponsoring us as always. We've talked about them a few times with ProGuard and everything else that they do, but if you're looking for mobile app security, utilities or testing, whatever, give GuardSquare a shout. Outside of that, we don't have multiple training opportunities listed yet. I haven't updated the training site. There are going to be more popping up. We've applied to a couple of different places, but the biggest one is Black Hat Europe right now. That's, I think, early December. You can find it at blackhat.com if you are interested. That is Agentic AppSec. Nope, it's AI Enhanced AppSec. Sorry. There's a slightly different course that we do that's specific to Black Hat that does dive into how to build a pipeline, an AppSec pipeline using LLMs. So very relevant. It's what Ken and I are doing basically on a day-to-day basis now, how to improve and actually start that process. But it gives you the fundamentals of how to dive into each of those different things. I'm getting more and more requests from clients. I mean, I know Ken's building this on the back end, but from a third party perspective, I am getting more and more requests from clients to actually help them with this process. No one understands the basics, really. There's been a lot of activity around it. So we talk about DEF CON and Black Hat. We're going to talk through some of the agentic architectures and other things that we saw there, or that I saw there during some of the talks, and how it applies. But it was really early in the game. I mean, kudos to Ken on this, right? Like actually rolling a lot of this out and trying to force LLMs to do what we wanted them to do, as opposed to being just fancy token prediction machines. They're still fancy token prediction machines, don't get me wrong, but we can use them to speed up our process. So check that out, blackhat.com for that training. I will get the training site updated so you can see that. Otherwise, a couple of other places that I will be, and Ken, I'm going to ask you the same question here shortly. I know you haven't been traveling too much, but there's B-Sides Cache Valley, which is in Utah. It's a sister conference to B-Sides Salt Lake City. That's in the middle of September. We will be up there. Actually, we're just one of the sponsors. And then I am helping run the AppSec community at SaintCon. So that'll be a good time. That's the end of October. So that's kind of my fall, I guess. Ken, what's on your docket as far as conferences go or travel or where people could actually meet you?
I'm definitely LastCon. But give me one second here, because now that you mentioned it, I was like, oh, I need to actually go in and look at where my submission's at for SaintCon. That's going to do. Okay. So I was accepted for SaintCon as well. So,
booyah.
I need to figure out and reach out to them to make sure I don't. Because I'll need to, I'm sorry, I'm doing this live with everybody, but I'm just realizing I'm going to need to like quickly fly from Austin to Salt Lake to make this work. But it is fine. I'll make it work. I'm excited. I really wanted to do SaintCon for a long time.
SaintCon's awesome. So, and SaintCon, just for everyone, I mean, I know it's sold out. It's becoming another DerbyCon that's out west here. It sold out in 20 minutes this year. Dude, I'm excited, Ken. Right? I can't tell you how excited I am that you're gonna.
I know. I actually thought what I was about to tell you is like, hey, it didn't get accepted. That's actually why I was double checking. I was like, because before I said that, I didn't want to be like too negative or anything or whatever.
Exactly.
Or just inaccurate. So, but like, this is the first time hearing it. I didn't even see it in my email, so that's awesome.
Awesome. So SaintCon runs for 4 days, right? Like it's a sprint. And it's during the week, right? So Tuesday through Friday, and multiple villages. I mean, it's a mini DEF CON for sure, right? Like and there's a lot of the same people that are there that do actually help run DEF CON because DEF CON's so close. But yeah, depending on when last CON and when you have to speak there, I have done both of those in the same week before and just like shuttled back and forth. So sweet. That's great.
I'm excited for that. That's going to be great. Yeah. I've never, so because like not to just keep on this topic, but I don't know if everybody knows, like you've been to my house, you've been to my, like twice, you've been to my old house, been to this house after we moved. I have never been to Seth's house, let alone, I think I've just driven through, like literally on my way from Nevada to Virginia. When I was moving out to Virginia, that's the only time. It's just a quick drive through. So I don't even know what Salt Lake's like. I don't know what your house is like. I have never been up there to spend any significant amount of time any part of Utah. So I don't know, man. Like I'm really, even just for that alone, let alone this conference you talk about, you've talked it up every year. You're like, oh, this is getting bigger and bigger. Last time you said it was like, I think a couple thousand or a few thousand people or something. And you said that it's just it had a lot of different stuff in general, like just a ton of tracks and a ton of content. So anyways, I'm excited. This is cool. This is really neat. Awesome. What a nice day. I get my first day of pumpkin spice latte. Today's the first official day of pumpkin spice lattes. Last year I learned that I am very much basic.
Yes.
And love
it. Fine. Just own it. Right?
Yeah. I'm going to bring you a pumpkin spice latte because they'll still be in season. So.
That is true.
I'll buy you one.
Sweet. Cool. Well, what talk are you going to be giving there? Just out of curiosity.
Well, so this talk is about, sorry, actually let me pull it up to make sure it's the right. Yeah. So this is like basically how to govern an agentic workforce, right? So that's going to be, you know, pretty awesome. Much the gist of it is, how the kind of where I see the future going, how to manage that and what in a practical way you can do to apply that. So it should be pretty good. I'm stoked. But now I'm thinking, sorry, again, I don't belabor this, but I'm thinking maybe even of bringing the family out. So we'll solidify this.
We'll figure it out. Cause there's a lot that we could actually go do anyway. Awesome. Well, you talk about agentic, you know, how to manage a swarm of agents, right? Like whatever that actually is. I've been seeing quite a bit of activity around like different, basically testing harnesses, right? Like dynamic testing harnesses or red team agentic workflows, right? Like that has been a primary focus during DEF CON. I think Jason Haddix gave his like agent talk 3 or 4 times, right? In different villages, on different stages, bug bounty, AI, AppSec, noob village, whatever it was, right? Like there was 3 or 4 different places that he actually spoke about this. There was a main stage talk from from Albert Corsa as well, you know, taming the swarm. I'm going to drop this in here. I haven't seen this one show up on YouTube yet, but you can find the content in the paper on media.defcon.org for that one, which is pretty interesting, like lessons learned about how to manage agents, right? Or how much it actually costs to try and do something like this. But he does have, like, specifically that talk that we went to, Albert, he's got a really good handle on what the architecture looks like, right? And what it is that you and I have also implemented to how to actually instruct agents and do other things. This mix of determinism and creativity, right? Like, so your deterministic tools and harness matched with the creativity of the LLM and the probabilistic nature of that is the power of using those agents. So, you know, go check some of those out. Yeah, I don't know, like, from a Black Hat perspective, I know you were pretty busy during Vegas. I mean, we both were, obviously.
Yeah, we both were.
I'm just fairly clear. We were both fairly busy.
Right? The first 5 days, we were like, just you and I, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And so, like, I know, like, we didn't necessarily get to a lot of the talks, right? Like, but I wanted to pick your brain because you were, you know, you were down on the floor. You did do the Black Hat side of things from a business perspective. Yeah, what was your overall impression? What were your thoughts this year? Also, like, what were your highlights? What were your lowlights? Right, like, just kind of whatever you want to throw in there around the Black Hat period.
Yeah. Oh man, actually. So
I'm asking a lot, making it too wide of a question, but go ahead.
No. Actually, pretty helpful probably for, okay. So for everybody, Seth was there. I know we talked about this, but Seth was there for 12 straight days. He got in on the 31st. He didn't leave until the 12th. So very long day for him. By the way, can you hear any noise in the background? Okay, cool. All right. My sound canceling is working. In any case, let me also still just close the doors. So you were there for 12 days, but I, on the way to the airport, talked to my son, maybe felt a little bad. I was going to miss his birthday, so I flew back. So I missed the DEF. So I just want to say that outright. I didn't do the 12 days like Seth did. I went home for a couple days during DEF CON proper, and then came back to do the training on Sunday. So just straight away. For Black Hat, you and I both got there on the 31st. We did 4 straight days. I would say the highlight of, because like the next 2 days were the conference, but you and I, well, at least for me, I had other stuff, which I'll talk about going on. But in any case, so first 4 days of training, the highlight would just be the people that we met for me. Like, our students were great. I mean, we had a big class. I forget the final numbers, but I think it was at least 26 people, I believe.
26, yeah.
Yeah. And it was really awesome. Like, I got to meet some great people. Our class built, I mean, I actually took a picture at the end of that class because I've never seen a presentation built so beautifully and like in such a nice way. But so yeah, we had some students do some really killer stuff. So it was really, really neat. And they were very curious and they asked good questions and we covered a lot, and it's an exhausting course for them. And they did a good job. The highlights also on that is like the professionalism of the staff. They've obviously done this quite a bit. And it's a big, you know, it's a big show basically. And in fact, that's the interesting thing. I think when you go to Mandalay Bay and that whole Black Hat side, is like my whole career. And I know you're very much the same. My whole career has been focused on more of like the practitioner, like the DEF CONs, the B sides, those kinds of places are where I go. I don't go to Black Hat typically. Now we started training on that Black Hat circuit and now I have a business. So that was my other 2 days during the conference. I was basically, here's an interesting thing. I think a lot of people are now hip to this, but this has become a trend. But, you know, some time ago, I would say at least since last 5 years, I've seen a trend of people moving away from booths, moving to like, or having both, having a booth and a suite. But like, for, if you're not, basically, if you want to, it's a weird thing. Your booth is more about, for it to be effective, it's more about advertising that you're doing well, basically, it seems like. I mean, there's other stuff you can set up, obviously, and that's kind of a silly statement to a degree, because you can, you know, they set up these sessions where people can come and they can like learn about your product and all this kind of stuff. I know that because the one thing that I can say is like, I actually did a presentation with Veracode because, you know, now DryRun Security, our company, has partnered with Veracode. They kind of realized, not kind of, like their customers are realizing like, hey, like we need to modernize. And so Veracode needs an answer for that. And we're their answer right now. And so we did a joint set of presentations at their booth. And that was actually pretty cool because I've never experienced what it's like to be at like one of those. I don't know how much they pay, but I'm sure it was like $500,000 or $250,000 or something crazy. I'm sure because they're right there up front. So I've never been a part of one of those big booths. I've never been talking to people at them and doing sessions. So that was actually a neat experience. Granted, I didn't actually talk. I was there for like a presence, but I got to give a shout out to Zach on my team, Zach Fowler, who we met through KernelCon, who I say that because Adam's here, who runs KernelCon. I see him in the chat. But yeah, so thank you, Adam, for putting that on because I wouldn't have met Zach otherwise. But yeah, shout out to Zach for his good session there. My point being is that I basically was either in the suite or involved in that. So for me, I didn't see any black hat talks. I can't speak to that intelligently. And, you know, again, one thing I will say, though, sorry, the last thing I'll kind of talk about here is that we all know it's a business, heavy business focused conference. We all know that. But like, my God, it for me was a realization of just how much of an industry this actually is. I think that was the thing that it wasn't like, you know, this year's theme's AI or this year's whatever. It was more just like, it kind of hit me when I saw the scale and the size and the sheer volume, especially this is one thing I think you would agree on that night before we, so the night, so it'd been Saturday. I think it would have been, It would have been, I think, Monday night or Tuesday night, maybe Tuesday night, where everybody came in. And that's when you start to see the scope of what we're talking about and the scale of what we're talking about. When you're doing training, yes, there's a decent amount of people still for training. There's a lot of people. They run a lot of classes. So there's still a lot of foot traffic. But it's nothing compared to that next day when it actually, the floodgates open, the expo center or whatever they call it, business or whatever center opens. And
business hall,
That was like, for me, I guess I realized like you and I have been here from pretty much the early day start. To see that was like, wow, this is way bigger than even I can comprehend now.
Yep. Yeah. It's always an interesting dynamic, right? Like, you know, I get the same impression too. If you ever go walk the RSA floor and the amount of money that's poured into a lot of this, and you realize that there is the practitioner side, there is the technology side, but the business side probably drives just as much revenue. Part of this whole like go to market thing is getting your name out there and actually being able to build a company. Yes, you have a product, but all of the other pieces that go around that from a business perspective to make it, to drive it and actually like be successful in the market. That's where a lot of that VC money goes, right? Like, let's be honest, right? Like I'm paying for a booth at Black Hat would probably bankrupt me as a small company, right? Like, or like even like a mid-sized booth that's there. Cause we just, you know, we're not dealing with that same scale. So to get to that scale, you've got to invest quite a bit on that other side. The booths are crazy. They're, you know, yeah, I walked it a little bit, the floor, but my team came in. They were coming in for DEF CON because, again, that's the conference that we typically go to. And so I didn't do too much over on that side.
I was going to ask you, did you spend any time in the Black Hat proper, like technical, you know, talks or anything like that?
I streamed some of them, right? Like, and that's where I watched here. I was going to post this in there. I watched this OpenAI Hugging Face like breakdown live when it actually happened. And if you haven't seen this, this is, you know, a fascinating just timeline of how a, you know, model training actually resulted in the Hugging Face incident from OpenAI's perspective and how models were are breaking out of the restrictions and guardrails that are being presented to them, and even the environments themselves. A lot of it from a watch perspective or from an analytics perspective is the brute force nature of what's going on, right? The fact that AI, especially when they're given unlimited tokens and a task, don't stop, right? Like you and I always talk about this in the like secure code review or the LLMs course, where you know we give humans time, right? Like you kind of like do things in spurts, you concentrate, and then you like take into account that you're human and you have to go off and get a cup of coffee. And you gotta use, you know, you have a bio break or you're doing what else, and you can only concentrate for so long. Agents, AI specifically, doesn't have that same restriction, right? And that's part of the reason that we love it for spinning out all of these specific tasks. But if you go watch that talk, is basically all I can say there. Go watch that talk, because the nonstop nature of, I try this, okay, that didn't work. I try this, okay, that didn't work. I try this, is very reminiscent of what we do during testing activities and assessments themselves. It's like, hey, I go try this, it didn't work. All right, now I try like 10 or 12 different things. I get frustrated and I probably lose focus a little bit and I like shift to something else. I go on a different side quest, I go somewhere else. Whereas you can focus in an agent to maintain if you've only given it very, very specific tasks and you keep it on target. And that's basically what happened with OpenAI here and with this model as they were trying to train it is, hey, it was only given one or two specific tasks and an unlimited budget to go after that and solve that task. When they forgot to get to provide certain files and certain, basically it was misconfigured, right? When it comes down to it. And I know I'm breaking down the incident here, but the task that it was given was misconfigured. So it wasn't given the files that it needed to actually accomplish that task. So it looked for different access paths to gain access to those files, number one, because they weren't on the local system, and happened to find like different places where it could write and ask other agents questions as well, other AIs that were in training. They didn't have access to it, so it started to look outside of that, figured out how to proxy itself out to the internet to get to other resources as well. Just very inventive, similar to what a person would do if we were in that same situation. And so you can see how it actually got there, but you can also see where the guardrails failed when we're putting them into jails or, you know, into locations that don't necessarily have access, and it only has a single access path or a single entry path to get data or other things. So it's going to use what it has access to actually expand its knowledge base. That's really what happened. It was just wild to me that there was like, we're just everyone under the sun, right? Basically was like, what you gonna do, right? Like, you know, there hasn't been a lot of, I don't know, like consumer level backlash to this, or like even security backlash that OpenAI is responsible for this incident. I know they've kind of taken that on, that they are responsible, but there hasn't been a lot of public pressure there, unless I'm not seeing things. I mean, have you seen anything? I feel like I'm talking about something that happened months ago, and it was only like, you know, 3 weeks ago or whatever that this actually, you know, came about.
You mean around the time of a major security conference?
Yeah.
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 All
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyways, I don't know what else to say. Like, it's not surprising to me. I guess the only it's not surprising to me that there's not, I don't know. Actually, I should take everything I just said back, because everything's been wonky and weird in this new paradigm that it really is like a new paradigm that we're living in. And I have so many thoughts here, and like, where do you even begin? I mean, it's influenced everything from like the, and I have like some articles, two articles coming out about some of this stuff, but it's influenced a lot of the decision making from the top, and not in a great way. But in terms of people like backlash or whatever, I think people are just more just probably dealing with the bit of surprise around it. Because, you know, again, for some people, it's not surprising. You know, folks who are maybe more used to dealing with these systems and have a little bit more experimentation or even engineering under their belt around agentic systems. But for, you know, other people, it might be like, the only things I saw were pretty much like sort of a shock and then a wait, but that can't be possible. But wait, how is that possible? Oh, here's my analysis on how that was possible. That's kind of what I watched over and over again. I didn't see a lot of like, but is this responsible? Is this irresponsible? Should we be doing this? Should we be doing that? Yeah, nothing. Yeah. I didn't see any. I mean, that's my network. Doesn't mean that conversation isn't happening. I'm sure that it is, but from a safety perspective. But yeah, I've been digging in a lot lately on sort of like, it's like even the what's Mythos ready, like what does that mean? So like I downloaded recently the CSA's kind of guide to what it means to be Mythos ready. But then I've been asking people, and recently I can't talk about the company I was on a call with, but I was on the call with a major enterprise. And I was like, can I ask you a question? Why does it matter what model you use, kind of thing, right? And like, what is your idea of being Mythos ready that we use Mythos, or what does that mean? And the response is something that's really stuck with me, which was like, well, it's not about necessarily being Mythos ready. It's showing that we have the same capabilities as Mythos. Which then kind of spun me off, because I was like, well, Mythos is just a model. And I still sometimes don't think people understand that there's the model as one capability, but you build around that. There's a lot of things you build around the model. Models, you introduce it at certain points where it makes sense. I'm not saying you do like entire analysis only agentically. That's not what I'm saying, but I think that that's what people are. So I have an article coming out about this, a harness versus agentic orchestration. Hopefully this week, I guess should get released. I've done everything I need to do, but it's got to go through marketing copy and all that, and review. But in any case, so that's, why am I saying that? I'm saying that because like that the real revelation I have is like, no, like you shouldn't be trying to be on par with attackers. You should be ahead of attackers. And that prompted me to be like, well, what advice can I give people to like stay ahead and build systems that are better than Mythos? Because I don't think people really, sometimes when I talk to them, realize like you can build a better than Mythos system, even with a less capable model. It's just you can't rely entirely on the model, and you shouldn't be relying entirely on the model's performance for doing certain things, right? That's just not how it's never how it should have worked. But it is how people are kind of harnessing around an LLM, kind of basically offloading pretty much everything to the LLM workload wise, with tool access, with some context, maybe with a little knowledge base, whatever. And there's just so much more to it, as you and I know, from engineering production grade systems. And also it's just like, you can't ever, if basically you wrap a model, you can never really get better than what that model offers. Right. So there's a lot of thoughts I have, Seth, about a lot of things here, but I guess back to your original point, there's not a lot of backlash from the safety or guardrails of that OpenAI. But bringing you back to that, like there's not, I haven't seen any conversations around that.
Okay.
Have you seen?
I mean, the ones that I've seen, it's similar to what Bobby's talking about in chat here, right? Like everyone's highlighting sandboxing, right? Like negligence. That was the driver for the AI that was being trained, was the lack of configuration and the negligence that was there. I mean, sandboxing, we know that it's always weak, right? Like there have been escapes for years. I mean, you've got an AI that you've probably trained on data and exploits of sandboxes as well, right? Like that's going to be in its training set. So it being able to find a novel escape is not really outside of the realm of possibility. You're giving it quasi like reasoning abilities, and it looks and sees, oh, it looks like I need to be able to proxy out to the internet to do something. What is the sandbox? What do I have access to? Right? Like, it's not like those logical leaps aren't that hard to make if you understand how models are actually put together. So, on the mythos point, Ken, this begs an interesting question because I'm interested to hear, you know, number one, what that response was from a client, but also the wider community, what it means to be mythos ready. I'll give my answer, because I think it'll be pretty much in line with most of the tech practitioners that are out there. But mythos ready to me, and when I discuss this with clients, is the ability to respond to unexpected targeting from AI and human agents that has increased in velocity. So it doesn't necessarily have to do with the model. It's just the fact that, hey, we're seeing that pen testers, bug bounty professionals, and even malicious actors are utilizing agents to go after specific companies. So to be mythos ready, right? Like, kudos to Anthropic to coining the term, I guess, is being able to either respond to that quickly or to be able to sandbox and identify what's coming in and when the attack actually happens in an appropriate amount of time so that you limit the blast radius of what actually happens. So that's my question to you and also to anybody in Slack or that's listening is, what do you feel like is, what is it to you to be mythos ready? And I kind of hate the fact that I'm using that term so much, right? I'm going to be honest, but that's where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have much of an opinion on what it means. I really kind of was going based off of what I've heard it mean to other people. Because I frankly don't care. Like, I think a lot of it's like when people hear about scary things, and then they're like, well, you need to have a strategy to, you know, and it's not to say that doesn't make sense. It totally makes sense. Like if I'm the, I don't know, if I'm the CEO of a company and someone comes out and says like in the news, like, oh, there's this thing now that's like hacking everybody's stuff. Like, you know, and attackers are getting access to things, either that model or like similar capability models. And even if they don't have it today, this is going to come. This is coming. This is a down the road thing, but not too far down the road. Like quickly, you know, on the roadmap, it does make sense that I'm going to go to my CISO and be like, "Hey, what's your strategy for this?" And so that's where that question, at least from all my conversations, that's where it comes from. It's like what are we doing to like not get hacked by T-1000 robots that just have access to like Nmap and stuff, right? So it's not a weird question to ask. It's not whatever. And then, so then it comes down to like, what are the ramifications of, you know, what are the ramifications of that? And then part of what I've been working on in this article is like trying to understand what are the advantages attackers have versus the advantages defenders have. And when you really peel back what advantage the defenders have is like, they get access to things before they ship potentially. And it may not be them as a person. It may be through their tooling. It may be through other things that they put into place. I'm hand waving, but I actually mean like specifically paved paths, following the use of certain libraries in a certain way, like guardrails, you know, just all the things that you do to build a secure product. We usually get to do those things before attackers do. And even if you're in a more mature organization, before features get shipped, you can give them to your like your pseudo attackers, your private bug bounty, or your private researchers, and they can use their systems as well to find those vulnerabilities. That's our advantage. The downside is that then you think about things like these packages that have been coming out, right? Where it's like, oh, in a 3-hour window, you could potentially exploit half my developers are working on NPM backed projects, right? Then the solution is we'll use a registry that's secure, but like, let's be honest, that's not guaranteed, right? There's no guarantees with that. It's a nice to do. It's another layer to the onion, but it's not like a guarantee that I won't somehow have a malicious package downloaded onto my machine, or even worse, put up into this, you know, or arguably maybe even worse in the CI/CD system. And then like someone can pivot off of a GitHub action and grab some tokens and pivot farther and whatever. That's the disadvantages that we have to give AI. We have to give humans access to things quickly and ship quickly. And especially now in this modern age, the development velocity is expected to be, like, when I say expected, I mean, there's actually metrics now where people are tracking, like, how many, this is a shit metric, but it's like, how many PRs did you ship this week and stuff like that. So there's an expectation now that you're going to ship more. It's not that you're going to get more free time to do higher level thinking. It's that you're just going to shit out more features, basically. So you combine the need to constantly develop, use autonomous systems with a pretty weak security landscape on that front. But then on top of that, you have attackers who are using, you know, automation to then create these packages in multiple ecosystems where, you know, developers are at a disadvantage and could be exploited before you even know about it. So there's advantages, there's disadvantages. Some of it's speed, but I do think, like, the idea that somehow Mythos is going to, like, destroy your organization. I have my thoughts there. If you have no security strategy and whatever, like, you got low hanging fruit and you haven't done the right things, or even if you have done the right things, things happen. Sure, there's always risk, but, like, is it as scary as I feel like people in the boardroom make it? No, it's not. And that's the frustrating part, is you have to answer. Basically, I have to answer questions that sometimes I don't feel like I want to answer.
Or not necessarily relevant.
But you've been. It's not an option. I have to still be like, yes, here's my thoughts on that. And yeah.
So. You've been talking to GRC again.
What does that mean? Yeah. I mean, what's it mean to you? What do you talk? Your clients ask you, like, how do you make? Has anyone ever actually asked you, like, can you make me Mythos ready yet?
They haven't coined it in that way, right? Like, they haven't asked it in that specific language. But we are getting more and more requests about speed and kind of continuous assessments, right? And to Bobby's point, right? Like, Mythos is the new synonym for APT. I know he said that tongue in cheek, but that is really what it is. Hey, we are being targeted, and we're seeing vulnerabilities against kind of the long tail of applications, especially for large companies that were not targeted in the past because they are accessible. And those are usually the ones that are a little bit more brittle. Bug bounty professionals have always done this. They've looked for those soft targets, but now you've got a system that can go out and search for soft targets and just continually search until they find one. So that's where that persistent threat is coming from, is the models and the agents that are out there just combing. And then the number of vulnerabilities have just increased. I've told this to you in the past as well, like, our use of agents to actually help assist in testing activities and assessment activities have increased the number of findings that we have, and also the quality of the findings that we are identifying, because it allows us to brute force things that we were not, like, in the past, we'd have to spend 2 or 3 days to build a harness to test out a very specific experiment. And now we're spinning it up very quickly using something like Claude or Codex, and then actually able to test that. It's kind of throwaway code, to be honest, but we are exploring avenues and parts of the application that we haven't in the past, because we have new tools at our fingertips, right? That's where that persistent threat is coming. So it's an advantage, to your point, for defenders to use those tools, but it's also an advantage for attackers because they now have an agent that never sleeps. And yes, some of those, like, Mythos-wise, right? Like, Mythos was the first one that came out that, like, really showed kind of these capabilities, but local agents, open source models can be used for this, agentic workflows. Like, you and I both know the power of using something that's less expensive to actually accomplish the same task. You can build that and put that together. You don't have to go to Anthropic and spend $10,000 in tokens to get this same sort of result that Mythos is spitting out.
Well, so, I mean, even further than that, because token spend, believe it or not, yeah, of course, token spend matters to a lot of companies. But I'm saying, believe it or not, to the audience, because like you sat there and you straight up heard the same things. Like I know one of our students in our Black Hat course represents a very large enterprise. And because I spend most of my time talking to very large enterprises, they all have the same sentiment on that, which is like, I don't care. It's not my money. And they said to spend money on AI. And I'm going to tell you right now, nobody cares. But what I would tell you is, if you're not concerned about that, the one thing I would be concerned about, right, is introducing a cascading failure. And we talk about this so much, and I'm going to talk about it now, which is that every time you introduce probability into your operation, there's room for cascading failure. So for instance, if I incorrectly identify the type of application that we're reviewing during context gathering using probabilism, right, then what happens? Then when we create plans using probabilism on what we're going to review and what things need to be, you know, if I like, okay, well, now I'm going to look at, say, authentication. Well, if I've collected the wrong context and I don't know the right components of the application, I don't know what type of application, if all that's gone wrong, then everything else when we get to authentication is going to go wrong. And then everything that's based off of what we found in authentication, that will go wrong. And then that just, it creates these cascading failures. I've seen it way too many times. So the right approach is to use probabilism only where it makes sense. That's the thing that I'm like going to advocate for people when they build these systems. Like, it'll be like my soapbox from here on out. I've decided this is just try to explain that you really have to understand when to introduce semantic reasoning and probabilism, and then, or maybe not semantic reasoning, but semantic understanding. And then when to use determinism. Determinism's nice, not just for price, but for cost of tokens and all that, but it's also like, and for like the stupid things you deal with, like missed tool calls or like retries and fallbacks and all the issues that happen when your agents are doing long horizon tasks or even sometimes short horizon tasks where they like model just hiccups for whatever reason. Anyways, my point is that even if it's not one of those types of scenarios, we're basically trying to keep. Let me rephrase this. It's not just token cost. It's not just the issues with outages and things like that. It's if it makes the wrong decision, and you've leaned too heavily on the decision-making of agents, that thread just keeps going. It just keeps going. So the approach I would say we recommend in the course, and I recommend to people, is if an operation doesn't require probabilism, don't use it. Extract package files and versions deterministically. Figure out some things about the application deterministically. This isn't me saying like, I think there is a potential for confusion here where people think, oh, does that mean you're saying run a deterministic scanner of some kind and then, you know, use AI on top of that to do some sort of like validation investigation or something? That's not what I'm talking about. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if I have a 120 step agentic long horizon task, you know, we'll say 30 of those steps or 40 of those steps should be, you know, maybe agentic reasoning or something like that. And the rest of it, we'll say, you know, I forget what I threw out, like 80, the other 80 or whatever, you know, maybe that's a set of deterministic operations that occur before getting to probabilism. Hopefully that makes sense. But it's a really important concept. For so many reasons, there's outages, there's token spend, but then there's just like inaccuracies and making bad decisions based off of inaccuracies.
Yeah.
Anything to add there?
I did want to go back to something that you highlighted right at the beginning, like this, large company, you know, developer access to tokens. This goes back to the discussion we had last week as well with Jivan, that there is like token spend for developers or engineers at most companies, that they are allotted a certain amount to be able to accomplish their job. I mean, typical to any other tool that you would use in a large enterprise, right? Obviously, like as you deal with the mid to small businesses, that's probably going to become a larger discussion point as far as how many tokens or how much like someone on your team can actually use to spend, right? Like and how they can utilize those AIs. So you might see more use of open models at some of the, you know, the smaller companies, but at the large one, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, I remember that discussion that you were having with it, you know, with the student at Black Hat, where they were like, yeah, I just don't really care. I'm going to use whatever I want. And until I get told no. Right. Like, and that's the typical. Yeah.
It's okay, but you're only, but the two problems are you're not getting the best system that you can. And even if you're using Mythos, you're only as good as like Mythos system. Are limitations. Yep. Like that's the other thing too, that's interesting that I don't think people realize too, is that like, I keep hearing, and I'm hearing two different arguments and it's confusing people. And I think maybe there's some clarity that can be provided. So the two different arguments are LLMs are getting so much better about dealing with hallucinations. And the other argument goes completely the opposite way. And I know if Pete's watching, he's going to laugh at this, goes the completely opposite way, which is like, no, they're hallucinating more than ever. And guess what? Both are true. This is what people don't seem to grasp about LLMs conceptually sometimes. Sometimes I say people, but what I'm saying is like, sometimes, sorry, I know there's a lot of people working on agentic systems. So there's a lot of knowledge out there. I'm not saying all people. I'm saying the people that I seem to come across when I, especially when this harness thing comes up, this phrase harness, when this comes up, I try to explain that. Okay, yes. So like, for instance, these things get optimized for certain purposes, right? So like, I don't know, maybe I'm just going to make something up. Maybe writing code for, you know, the top X number of languages, less hallucinations, everything's getting better. Great, right? However, when you talk about using a system like I was talking about, where you're not using the LLM for hey, is this code secure or insecure, for instance? And instead, you have like I've talked about before, where we're like, first deterministically we do this repository graph reconstruction and Git graph reconstruction, so we can identify hotspots and figure out where risky places need to be investigated and what they need to be investigated for, right? So using determinism to drive and steer probabilism. Okay, so that's actually a good example of what I mean. Now, my point being is that when you do things like that, where you take different signals and then you make decisions based off those different signals, you find that maybe in this iteration of this particular model over here, it's better at understanding, say, I don't know, authorization boundaries in Java apps, or Spring apps or something like that. But then when it gets down to, say, being able to correctly understand the config file of something, then it maybe like, or interpreting why something was built or whatever interpretation operation we needed to do and understanding operation we needed to do, it, that's where we see the hallucinations, right? It's too broad of a question to be like, is this secure or is this insecure, right? Like, or like to be thinking about the LLM's performance in that way. Or, hey, here's a target, could you break in? That's just, you're missing so many nuances. There's so many little decision points and so many different types of understanding and so many different types of analysis happening that it may be super, super strong, like incredibly in the 90% high accuracy range strength. But then when it gets down to some other thing, it's like, I wasn't trained on that. So now I'm hallucinating like crazy. And that's what we're talking about. That is happening. I don't know if people recognize that, but that is happening, where like the better frontier models come out and they improve in one area and they totally go to shit on another area. And this is why when people always ask me when I get calls, this is like one of the most common questions, which model are you using? And I'm like, okay, let me get out the sheet of 30 different models. These are exactly the
ones
that they're going to change next week. So I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. Anyways. I mean, we've got for all the testing that we do, we've got like a big old list of models, different providers, because it comes down to, you know, from a cost perspective, it comes down to like what's best for that specific task, which one is utilized best for that specific vulnerability or this specific use case. And it changes from week to week. So when we run evaluations, that list will change, right? It changes in general.
Think about you. If you just read one of these books off my shelf. Let's take that metaprogramming book in Ruby book right behind me, right? If you took that and you had just parsed through it, but then you hadn't touched, like, you know, you've done a lot of Python code, but let's say you haven't kept up with Python and it's been 5 years since you've written in Python and you just read this metaprogramming book and you've been writing in Ruby. I know it's sacrilege, but you've been writing in Ruby, right? Well, you're going to be very good about understanding some of the nuances of metaprogramming and how that works. Guess what you're not going to be good at? You're not going to know any of the new Pythonisms. You're not any like massive changes to the language. You're rusty now. Maybe you're like, and that's my point, is that there are going to be some things you're still going to be, you're going to be good at and maybe even better at because, you know, you've been trained on that. But then maybe there was some weakness in other areas, and it's no different from a human in that way.
Yeah. Nope, it's not, right? Like, and to your point, like this is, again, you have to blame Anthropic for a lot of this, like with the Mythos language that they're using, is we kind of think it's magical that it can just go discover all the things, right? And it's not wrong that it's going to find some stuff, but without like real direction, to your point of building out the deterministic bits to feed into that, it's never going to be a production system. It's never going to be an enterprise level system that's repeatable and that you can actually do more things with. So, yeah.
If you're throwing, sorry, not to keep going, but I'll just say this last thing. If you're throwing the kitchen sink at something, you don't, then all nuance is lost. You don't know why it came out with the outcome that it has. You kind of, you can do a little reconstruction, but it's not, you know, you don't have control over fixing that when it goes wrong. There's other techniques we've taught people to do to try to overcome that, but it's just hard if you're letting everything go off to the LLM and you're not like being very pointed about what questions you want to ask a probabilistic system.
Yeah. Yep. And just, you know, for listeners in general, right? Like Ken and I did not realize we were going to be talking about Mythos today for whatever reason.
Yeah, so many other articles and all kinds of other shit. This is what happens when you get a skip one.
Exactly. Well, it all comes from what we saw at Black Hat and DEF CON, right? Because everyone was talking about agents. Everyone was talking about harnessing LLMs and how to best utilize these systems. And there was a lot of just FUD around it, just in general from a marketing perspective. Most of the booth people that I talked to had no clue how they were actually implementing any of this, right? Like, because it was a marketing effort and they were just trying to get their name out there as one of the experts in the space. It was very rare that I ran into a tech practitioner. Whereas on the flip side, going to DEF CON and talking with people in the AI Village or Jason Haddix or Clint or whoever else, or Daniel Miesler, like those guys are actually doing that. And they've got their own techniques and harnesses that they've built to actually utilize these things. But that was the surprise to me. That talk that I highlighted is how we're all kind of coming to this same conclusion on the best way to actually instruct LLMs and where to utilize an LLM in that overall workflow with the deterministic bits. So if you go to any specific security firm for testing, they're going to be using AI. It's all about how they've actually built that and whether their instruction, just as it was that you would go to a specific organization to work with a person. Now, I feel like my prediction is coming about here. You are going to go to specific organizations for them to utilize their expertise in building and harnessing LLMs to actually accomplish these tasks. Cool. So with that, should we highlight that other, sorry, do you want to, should I,
yeah,
is there more that you want to say to this?
Actually, it's really funny. So I texted, okay, so sorry, this is going to be funny to you, hopefully, and to Anthony, who is obviously listening, or was. So Anthony had posted around the, like, you know, 0-day briefing, AI and all that stuff, back in April, I believe, Rob had posted, Rob Fuller, Mubix, M-U-B-I-X, yep. He had posted, content around this, right? I had skimmed the first couple pages. I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. Like, this is cool. And anyways, I texted him and Anyways, I texted him. He's actually, we're talking right now about it. And he's like, man, I feel like it's so out. Basically, he's like, oh, I feel like it's so out of date now. I need to like hurry up and whatever, whatever. But I just thought it was kind of a funny small world moment. I was like, oh, yeah, this is really cool. And he's already like texting back. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe he'll go and update this thing for the latest the latest I don't know what is out of date since April, but
Yeah.
I
Well,
guess
it's
everything
April, right?
changed.
Like that's 4 months ago. That may as well have been like 10 years ago at this point, right? Like tongue in cheek, but
No,
yes.
I didn't put it into StreamYard. I'm sorry. Oh, I did. Okay. Yeah, here it
Yeah,
is.
you did. Yep, that CISO brief. That's from Nubix. Rob has been on the podcast, I'm pretty sure, but it's been a while. So maybe we should have him back on. When he updates that, tell him that, right? Like update it and then let's come talk about it.
Yeah, so I'm saying
Cool.
I'm telling him right now.
Okay. Yep. Next up, just before we call it today, and we can just highlight this quickly. This was the talk. This was one of the talks from Fort Swigger. It's not from Gareth or yeah, James, right? Like this. So it's another researcher that's over there that spoke at DEF CON and Black Hat on CLRF powered desync attacks. It's interesting to me how in general, those guys have been really good about promoting each other's research and then building on top of, what their team has actually found. And you will find this with a lot of those research-based organizations, right? Tom Stacey, there you
Yeah.
go. And like the whole article, and I don't know what your takeaway is on this, right? Like I know when I talk with about like CLRF attacks and desync stuff in general, from an assessment perspective, from a scope perspective, we don't often find or we don't often run into this because our scope is typically the application itself and not the whole infrastructure that's in place around it. So this research builds on and takes advantage of the fact that Nginx basically decodes the URL and drops it into requests behind the scenes, right? Like it is a known flaw with Nginx. And so, they're looking at ways to take advantage of that and craft attacks around it, which is it's fascinating, right? To see how it can actually affect things. And I've seen the same sorts of problems like testing apps that are, very dependent on F5 firewalls or WAFs in general, right? Like if you can attack the underlying infrastructure, it opens up a whole bunch of possibilities that the application has no knowledge of and is just responding in the manner that the application should be responding in. I don't know, like, and that's just very surface level, my initial take on this research. What was your takeaways? I mean, I know we've already been going for an hour, crazy enough, but
I
yeah.
know. I thought, well, so just high level, it's very cool. I will say this. They exploited proxy pass. Proxy is pass is exactly what it sounds like. I'm going to forward on something to you. Mainly it decodes and then so URL decodes and then sends it off. This allows for new lines to be placed into the by the way, Rob just agreed to come on the podcast. So everybody hold his feet to the fire. He just said he would do it. So in any case, yeah, I think it's really cool to be able to inject a new line. And I have two specific cases myself that always stand out. And I've talked about each one of those cases in the secure code review course that we've done. The one was the token bypass for a Sinatra app where I was able to take over everybody's accounts. And the other one is very much similar to, oh gosh, now I'm forgetting what the other new line flaw was. It'll come back to me, but there are two very significant flaws in my career that have existed because of these new lines being introduced. And sorry. The other thing was actually no. It wasn't about new lines. That's not at all what it was about. It was okay. I think enough time has passed. It's 2026, right? So this would have been when we acquired NPM at GitHub. I think enough time has passed. So When we acquired them, we had gotten a bug bounty report where you could delete anybody's package at that time. And when we looked into it, what it was is there is a microservice front end that does the authorization before it forwards requests onto the back end. And no joke, it wasn't even anything cool like with a new line. And I'm bringing this up for a very, very specific reason. This is a follow up with this attack that they performed. But in any case, so what had happened was, I believe it was something like, I'm just going to go and kind of reconstruct this as best I can. There, I think in the URL, you put like a package ID or a name or something like that. When the front end sees it, it correlated your header, your token with the package that you want to update. And it says like, is that okay? And if so, forward on. But what we found was that, or what the attacker found was that if they added, I think it was in like the body of the request, that same parameter that was in the URL, the body would be respected by the service that basically it said, the front end said, oh, okay, you're good. I'll send that whole request off to the back end. And when the back end read it, it took the, not the URL parameter, but it took the body of the post request or whatever it was, this parameter value. And so it bypassed the authorization on that front end. Well, when you look at a lot of the attacks of what they pulled off in that article, and there's many, they show a lot of different ways to make this, to weaponize this attack. That's what a lot of it is. It's like a lot of this, we expected to read certain elements and then take action on whether it's a header or whatever it might be. But when they've split it out and basically smuggled in a separate request, then decision-making gets kind of screwed up, especially in a service-oriented architecture where you're like,
yep,
here you're good. But then when you get to this system or even the next system, you're not good. And it's going to read a different piece of the request. And so anyways, I thought it was very, very interesting. I've seen this before. I've just never seen CRLF used in that way at that scale for that many different attacks.
Yeah.
That's a long one. What is your breakdown? I mean, I'm curious, what do you think?
Yeah, and this is always my consideration when I start to think about this. And we've actually started to do more research on like kind of critical paths and chaining of vulnerabilities together, right? There's usually one that is crucial for the whole exploit chain to be successful, right? And in this case, that proxy pass, exactly what you're saying, this is the critical piece here, combined with the ability to basically stream requests, multiple HTTP requests in a single session. Okay? So one is support, right? Like this is an intentional decision that was made by in the HTTP spec so that we don't have to do as many TCP sessions when a single HTTP session comes around, right? That's just built into the protocol itself. Great, right? Like that should be there. There are reasons for that from availability and accessibility, whatever perspective, performance, right? But the flaw with ProxyPass, specifically with Nginx and how much we've built on top of Nginx using that utility is what makes this possible. So number one, most exploits have some sort of critical component, or exploit chains have a critical component that if you nuked that, the rest of it is just not a possibility. Number two, the novel ways to get around different protections or different hurdles within it is where the real research starts to happen. And there is, like, it's fascinating, right? Like, again, how much we actually value this. I know when we were first reading through the article, that was it. Like, you find a major critical vulnerability and they're able to, I don't know, take over somebody's account, change people's usernames, email addresses associated with those accounts on a shopping site. And then the critical nature of that is they're doing account takeover on a large scale. And then it's only paid out at like, was that the 500 or that was even like the $2,200 range, right?
Like, it's a 2,200.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me that was the top end value that they got for that. And part of me understands, like on the bug bounty side, like the company side, because they're looking at it and they're like, well, this is an infrastructure related thing. This isn't actually in our code. but it's still all part of the same application, right? Like, I know if you were at one of the large organizations, like say GitHub, that's critical. You're going to get a payday that comes down to that. And so, yeah, I mean, we just don't value this stuff, right? Like, and maybe it's just, it's a symptom of vulnpocalypse, right? That we're having to pay out like thousands and thousands of dollars at all these vulnerabilities that are coming at us or whatever it is, but it still feels like incredibly undervalued.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe that. I was like, you know, we're trying to incentivize, like, I mean, actually, one thing that was surprising to me is my old boss, Greg Osa at GitHub, when I first joined there, I was like surprised at how giddy they were to like give people a lot of money. You know, I was like, are you excited? Like it's very counterintuitive to be happy that someone found a flaw and then like paid a lot of money. But the way he explained it made so much sense. It's like, no, we're trying to like incentivize people to hammer on us. Like, we want the best of the best to like spend their time on us. So I'm happy that they find these things and I want them to get paid out. Significantly. This isn't just like feel good stuff for the internet. This is like legitimately how the culture is and how Greg thinks. And it just really stuck with me as like such a good way to look at bug bounty. And so when I see 2,200, now I'm not going to be a jerk, right? I don't know this company's financial position. And I don't know, because one thing that does happen, I will say this, there is one consideration. Sometimes with like the whole safe harbor thing where you find like a vuln in a library that's used in a different product, like it gets a little weirder, right? Because like a researcher in theory, if they find this issue with Nginx, granted, it's a little nuanced. It's different when it's you use that thing in a specific way that makes it vulnerable versus it's just inherently vulnerable. But in the situations where like we'll say a library or some technology is inherently vulnerable and you like tell us that we are vulnerable because we use that thing, the payout's not quite the same as like finding a four chained vulnerabilities together that lead from like a low to like, it went from like a low to like, oh, you chain these together and now you have an RCE. It's not the same. So I'll give them that. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I look at these things and you had mentioned the 2,200 and you mentioned 500. It's because there are two different payouts mentioned from that organization. It was like first 2,200, then there was a follow-up and where things weren't fixed and they told them about that. And then they paid them out 500. And I'm just for 2,700 all in for something that damaging where like you can... it is hard for me to reconcile because it's like you really do want this to flourish. And if you're paying that amount of money, you're incentivizing, are you incentivizing the right people for your program?
Yeah.
I don't love it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I know that's always been a big complaint, right? Like if you ever talk to, you know, we've mentioned Jason a few times today, Haddix, right? Like in the bug bounty world, that it's actually very difficult to do that on a daily basis, right? And get paid without some of those large scale like vulnerabilities and finding something that you can use and do across multiple different companies because one company's values it highly, another doesn't. That's just all part of the economic nature there that's associated with bug bounty. But I also start to question where that goes. I know this is a big discussion point in that community with the use of agents, with the use of AI and those assistants that are now running continually. Where, you know, what does that market look like? Because we know people that are at, you know, bug bounty companies, they're building their own AIs to actually do a lot of this stuff. And are they just going to like, where does a researcher actually fit? And now we're getting into a whole different discussion, but in general, it's it does feel undervalued. That's awesome. I guess is my bow on it. But, yeah,
I think the only thing I can add there, there is something I add, which is like I will tell you after having worked at a company who had like a very active bug bounty program, that there is now this is Portswigger, so I am not insinuating anything about Portswigger at all. I know they have great researchers. This is not about them. This is just generally speaking about all things that you read on the internet about bug bounty programs. do take into account heavily that there are two sides to every argument. And it's not just, it's more than that. It's like, there are sometimes also like cases where you can't even tell the researcher certain things. And I know that sounds lame or whatever. Yeah, but guess what? That's reality. Like sometimes there are actually like things you cannot say, and there are sometimes ways to phrasing things you have to be very careful. My point being is that, you know, just take that into account. Like not all like the researchers' stuff that you read where they're like, oh, this was unfair or that wasn't right, or you just can't.
Yeah.
Try to give
it. You're not seeing everything. Yep. Exactly.
You're not seeing everything. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Even the researcher is probably not seeing everything. That's my point.
Yep. Exactly. Well, and it's hard to actually like, you know, quantify that when it is internal discussions and politics that are never going to see the light of day. I did want to give a credit to Portswigger outside of the research, right? Like they did again call out this as the kind of crucial vulnerability in that exploit chain. The defense is actually fairly simple as to how this regex is put together, right? Like a simple regex change and all of a sudden it's done. But it does go back to this whole idea of like, oh, it's HTTP 1.1 instead of HTTP 2. And I know they want HTTP 1.1 to go away, but let's be honest, it's never going to go completely away. It's going to take a long time. All right. We've been going for a while today, Ken. We can go ahead and wrap things up. I did want to request listeners actually go out and give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. If you are listening to us, please just go mash that like button. You know, as Cameron from, you know, Chaos, God dang it, I'm going to get it wrong. Coffee, Chaos, and ProdSec. Coffee always comes first. From their podcast, you know, smash the like, leave us a review. Appreciate everyone listening and participating today. Makes our conversation better and actually drives us specific directions. I guess the general takeaway is figure out what it means to you to be Mythos ready and go do it. Any final thoughts, Ken?
He's right.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Well, yeah, actually just appreciate everybody's participation. It means a lot. It does mean a lot. Like it really does. Like we wouldn't have gotten through 331 episodes. We wouldn't continue. And we didn't even talk about it. We did do a community event at DEF CON. Appreciate everybody. Larry was there. Thank you, Larry, for coming out. Other folks were there. I know Mark Hoops was there. There's a lot of names I could name that were there and that I, again, really appreciate you all coming out. So just understand that you are what makes this continue, and it's you all are the most important part of this. And so, yeah, just thank you. Yeah, that's what I'd say.
Cool. All right. Well, watch this space. We'll chat with everyone next week and see y'all online.